Chapter 21, God's Law, God's Counsel. I'll admit, it's a little hard to get excited about the law of God. How many of us would echo Paul's sentiment that he delighted in the law of God in his heart? Romans 7:22. We certainly don't think of the law like David did. The law of Yahweh is perfect, reviving life. The testimony of Yahweh is firm, making wise the simple. The precepts of Yahweh are right, making the heart rejoice. The command of Yahweh is pure, enlightening the eyes. Psalm 19:7-8. We tend to think of the law as though every one of its 663 commands were an oppressive linchpin in a relationship to Yahweh. We tend to view the law negatively, as though it were given to produce feelings of guilt or to frustrate Israelites with the impossibility of pleasing God. This is misguided. The laws of the Torah broadly deal with a person's relationship to Yahweh. For example, worship, access to sacred space, relationship with fellow Israelites or outsiders, sex, business, property, and the nation's conventional bond with her God. The law was not a means of meriting salvation. An Israelite would have known that believing was at the heart of a right relationship with Yahweh, not mere mechanical observance to a list of do's and don'ts. For sure, some Israelites would have lapsed into this mistaken thinking, particularly after the shock of the exile. But that wasn't what the law was about. In other words, legalism was not intrinsic to a biblical theology of the law. The heart of salvation in biblical theology across both testaments is believing loyalty to Yahweh. That orientation extends from Eden and has deep roots in what happened at Sinai. It's no coincidence that when Israel, Yahweh's portion, met with him at Sinai, the result was a second covenant involving laws binding Israel and Yahweh in faithfulness witnessed by the members of Yahweh's divine council. The Cosmic Mountain, birthplace of the law. In the last chapter, we were introduced to the connections between Eden and Sinai. Both were sacred places where Yahweh's children saw him in human form. Genesis 3:8, Exodus 24:9-11. We ended our discussion with the provocative notion that the divine council was present at God's mountain, specifically during the giving of the law. The link between the law and the heavenly council is noted several times in the New Testament, which uses for the divine council the umbrella term angels. I close the last chapter with two passages that describe the law as delivered by angels, Acts 7:53, and declared by angels, Hebrews 2:2. When I first came across these New Testament verses, I had read a lot of the Old Testament and had never seen this idea, so I naturally wondered where the New Testament writers were getting it. It's actually a prickly problem. There are passages that describe angels at Sinai, but none of them specifically reference the law. For example, Psalm 68:15-18 reads, "A mountain of God is the mountain of Bashan. A mountain of many peaks is the mountain of Bashan. Why do you look with hostility, O many peaked mountains? This mountain God desires for his dwelling. Yes, Yahweh will abide in it forever. The chariots of God are twice 10,000, with thousands doubled. The Lord is among them at Sinai, distinctive in victory. You have ascended on high, you have led away captive, you have received gifts from among humankind, and even from the rebellious, so that Yah, God, may dwell there." Without direct reference to the law, the New Testament idea in Acts 7 and Hebrews 2 seems completely contrived, unless you're using your Old Testament, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that was the Bible of the early church. A second Sinai passage that is key text for connecting the law and the heavenly host is Deuteronomy 33:1-4. The Septuagint version has a multitude of divine beings at Sinai, whereas the traditional text does not. That isn't the only divergence either. Take a look at the passages in both versions, especially the underlying words. Chart. traditional Masoretic Hebrew text. Now this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the Israelites before his death. Then he said, Yahweh came from Sinai, and he dawned upon them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came with myriads of holy ones, at his right hand a fiery law for them. Moreover, he loves his people. All the holy ones were in your hand, and they bowed down to your feet, each one accepting directions from you. A law Moses instructed for us as a possession for the assembly of Jacob. Septuagint version. And this is the blessing which Moses, the man of God, blessed the Israelites before his death. He said, The Lord has come from Sinai, and he appeared to us from Seir. He made haste from Mount Paran with 10,000s of Kadesh at his right, his angels with him. And he had pity on his people, and all the holy ones were under your hands, even these were under you, and it, the people, received his words, the law which Moses commanded us, an inheritance for the assemblies of Jacob. The fundamental difference is that the Septuagint version has angels at Sinai, and the traditional text doesn't. In verse 3, the traditional Hebrew text seems to suggest that the holy ones are the Israelites who will receive the law. The Septuagint has angels at God's right hand, the position of authority, witnessing the giving of the law to Israel. Since the New Testament writers most often use the Septuagint when referencing the Old Testament, we can understand the point being made in Acts 7:52-53 and Hebrews 2:1-2. However, Galatians 3:19 adds a tantalizing detail that makes the connection more dramatic. Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made, and it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Galatians 3:19 informs us that there was an intermediary between God, the angels, and Israel. Most scholars assume this is a reference to Moses. Other scholars have noted that, in light of the very next verse, this is problematic. Now, an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. Why would Paul feel the need to clarify that God's uniqueness wasn't disturbed by this intermediary if it was just Moses? There is another solution, one that explains Paul's ensuing comment. The intermediary is Yahweh in human form. Deuteronomy 33 uses language requiring the appearance of Yahweh in human form. Appeared is right. In this light, Deuteronomy 9, verses 9 and 10, take on new significance. Moses says, When I went up the mountain to receive the stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant that Yahweh made with you, and remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, I did not eat food and I did not drink water. And Yahweh gave me the two tablets of stone, written with the finger of God, and on them was writing according to all the words that Yahweh spoke with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. This language is by now very familiar, the language of human physicality, finger applied to Yahweh. This is the stock description of the second Yahweh, the angel. It shouldn't be a surprise that the New Testament speaks of angelic mediation for the law. It was written by the angel who is God in the presence of council members, the holy ones, and then dispensed to Israel through Moses. The Sinai Law, Covenant, and Its Witnesses. The core idea of the law being delivered and declared by angels is depicted in Deuteronomy 33, verses 1 through 4. The divine beings of Yahweh's council witness the agreement. This information is provided somewhat cryptically, at least to our eye. We need to read closely and, to some degree, in Hebrew to catch the clues. Scholars agree that the events of Sinai after the Exodus established a covenant between Yahweh and his people Israel. Covenants were basically agreements or enactments of a relationship. Yahweh's deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt was prompted by the earlier covenant promises he had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Genesis 12, 1-3, 15, 1-6, 22:18, 26:4, 27:29, and 28:14. The events leading up to the miraculous deliverance from Egypt alluded to the earlier promises in Exodus 3, 7 and 8, 16 through 22, 6, verses 4 through 6, 13, 5, and 11. Abraham's offspring had become a multitude in Egypt, Exodus 1, 6 through 10, and as God had told Abraham centuries earlier, had become strangers in a foreign land, Genesis 15, 13. God had rescued them, and now at Sinai was setting the terms of the relationship. The covenant between Yahweh and Israel, enacted at Sinai, followed the conventions of a type of covenant known from ancient Near Eastern sources. Scholars refer to it as a vassal treaty. This type of covenant was, in essence, an oath of loyalty by an inferior, the vassal here, Israel, to a superior, Yahweh, the initiator of the agreement. The basic stipulations of the covenant relationship were what we know as the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, though there are other laws in Exodus 20 through 23. As with the earlier Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 15, 9, 10, a sacrificial ritual was performed to ratify the covenant, Exodus 24, 3 through 8. After the ritual, there was a sacrificial meal between the parties involved. This was the divine council scene in Exodus 24, 9 through 11 that we've already briefly noted. A formal vassal treaty in the ancient Near East regularly listed third-party witnesses to its enactment. As one scholar notes, the witnesses were exclusively deities or deified elements of the natural world. All gods relevant to both parties were called upon as witnesses, so that there was no god left that the vassal could appeal to for protection if he wanted to violate his solemn oath. The gods were covenant enforcers in this worldview. Israelites, of course, would not have recognized foreign gods in such a treaty. Consequently, most scholars considered this element absent in the Sinai Treaty account. But the Elohim of Yahweh's council were not foreign gods. They were Yahweh's host and witnesses to the giving of the law, at least according to the Hebrew text behind the Septuagint and the New Testament writers. They were also, as the account of Ahab in 1 Kings 22 indicates, Yahweh's means of punishing covenant apostates. It is at precisely this point that many scholars have failed to notice some relevant wordplay in the biblical text that also suggests this connection. The tablets of the law are referred to frequently in Exodus by the term Iduit. It is usually translated testimony in English Bibles. The term is used in parallel with Torah, law, in Psalm 19:7 and 78:5. So at the very least, it speaks of the written text of the law. In Exodus 25:16, informs us that Yahweh commanded Moses to place the Iduit in the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, the Ark was made for the Iduit. This explains why the Ark is also called the Ark of the Iduit. Exodus 25:22, 36, 39:25, 43, verses 5 and 21. Since the Ark traveled inside the tabernacle, that mobile tent structure was also called the Tabernacle of the Iduit. Exodus 38:21, Numbers 1:50 and 53, 10, verse 11. Or the tents of the Iduit. Numbers 9:5, 17:22 and 23, 18:2, 2 Chronicles 24:6. What makes this interesting is that the term Iduit can also mean witnesses. In fact, this plural's equivalent In Akkadian, the language of the vassal treaties that serve as a model for the Sinai Treaty in Exodus, is a technical term used exclusively of witnesses to such treaties. This is not to suggest that the term doesn't refer to the laws on the tablets. Rather, since the tablets themselves occupy sacred space reserved only for Yahweh's presence inside the Ark within the Holy of Holies, the term appears to signify that the tablets of the law were also a sort of proxy for the divine council members who witnessed the event. In other words, the tablets of the law were tokens of the event at Sinai itself. They were stone reminders of a divine encounter with Yahweh and his council, in much the same way that altars and standing stones are built by the patriarchs, would have reminded passersby that they marked a divine encounter. Genesis 12:7, 13:18, Exodus 17:15, and 24:4. Again, Yahweh's presence in his home, Eden, Sinai, Tabernacle, and eventually the temple, implies by definition his throne room along with his attending council. The tablets not only contained the covenant terms, but were a reminder of the event as it occurred, with the divine council present on Sinai. The law and salvation. In simplest terms, the Sinai covenant conveyed Yahweh's will for what he intended Israel to be, in relation both to him and to the disinherited nations. Israel was to be theologically and ethically distinct. These distinctions were obligations, not suggestions. Israel was to be holy, Leviticus 19:2, and fulfill God's original Edenic purpose of spreading his influence, his kingdom rule, throughout all the nations. Israel's status as Yahweh's own portion was not an end in itself, but the means by which Israel would draw all nations back to Yahweh, Deuteronomy 4, 6-8, 28, 9-10. This is the idea behind Israel being a kingdom of priests, Exodus 19:6, and a light to the nations, Isaiah 42:6, 49:6, 51:4, and 63. It's no wonder that the book of Revelation uses the same language of believers in Revelation 5:10, a divine council scene in connection with the ruling over all the earth. The entire nation inherited the status and duty of Abraham, that through him, and now them, all nations would be blessed, Genesis 12:3. But did this salvation come by obeying rules? To ask the question is to miss the point. Salvation in the Old Testament meant love for Yahweh alone. One had to believe that Yahweh was the God of all gods, trusting that this Most High God has chosen covenant relationship with Israel to the detriment of all other nations. The law was how one demonstrated that love, that loyalty. Salvation was not merited. Yahweh alone had initiated the relationship. Yahweh's choice and covenant promise had to be believed. An Israelite believing loyalty was shown by faithfulness to the law. The core of the law was fidelity to Yahweh alone above all gods. To worship other gods was to demonstrate the absence of belief, love, and loyalty. Doing the works of the law without having the heart aligned only to Yahweh was inadequate. This is why the promise of the possession of the promised land is repeatedly inextricably linked in the Torah to the first two commandments, staying clear of idolatry and apostasy. The history of Israel's kings illustrates the point. King David was guilty of the worst of crimes against humanity in the incident with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, 2 Samuel 11. He was clearly in violation of the law and deserving of death. Nevertheless, his belief in who Yahweh was among all gods never wavered. God was merciful to him, sparing him from death, though his sin had consequences the rest of his life. But there was no doubt that David was ever a believer in Yahweh and never worshipped another. Yet other kings of Israel and Judah were tossed aside, and both kingdoms sent into exile, because they worshipped other gods. Personal failure, even of the worst kind, did not send the nation into exile. Choosing other gods did. The same is true in the New Testament. Believing the gospel means believing that Yahweh, the God of Israel, came to earth incarnated as man, voluntarily died on the cross as a sacrifice for our sin, and rose again on the third day. That is the content of our faith, this side of the cross. Our believing loyalty is demonstrated by our obedience to the law of Christ, 1 Corinthians 9:21, Galatians 6:2. We cannot worship another. Salvation means believing loyalty to Christ, who was and is the visible Yahweh. There is no salvation in any other name, Acts 4:12, and faith must remain intact, Romans 11:17 through 24, Hebrews 19:10, 22, and 38 through 39. Personal failure is not the same as trading Jesus for another God, and God knows that. Believing loyalty was therefore not just academic. By definition, it must be conscious and active. Israel knew that her God had fought for her and loved her, but the relationship came with expectations. As she embarked for the Promised Land, Israel would have daily visible reminders not only of Yahweh's presence, but of his total otherness. Having the divine presence with you could be both fantastic and frightening.